Okay, please join me in extending a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, who is Patrick O. from Pleasanton.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight, glad to be sober. Nice to see all those people get chips. Happy birthday if you got a chip tonight. I thank you, Dave, for asking me to come up and talk. I always find that it's a privilege and honor to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone being asked to participate in AA. I think there are a lot of people out there that never even have the pleasure of darkening the doors of AA. The percentage of people is very small that even get to Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone to get here and be able to stay sober. I'm pretty grateful for that. So, my sobriety date is January the 17th, 1989. You'll hear people a lot of times in AA will say, you know, they'll give their sobriety date and say from that time to this, they haven't found it necessary to take a drink. It's not my experience at all. And I have found it very necessary on numerous occasions, but fortunately that hasn't happened. I would have to say that in early sobriety or perhaps early undrunkenness, I would have to attribute that mostly to dumb luck and probably just good people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I became an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was here a couple of years before I became an alcoholic. That was just my perception, I suppose. I grew up in a town south San Francisco, which is down in the Bay Area, and I probably started drinking. I think maybe at 13 years old, 14 years old, something like that. The first time I remember actually going to intentionally buy alcohol, I was with two buddies of mine, and we were at the corner of Spruce and Grand in South San Francisco, a little tiny liquor store called Al's Liquor. And we were taking turns asking people to buy up for us. And so it was my turn. Like I say, I'm probably 13 years old, and I go up and ask this guy if he'll buy up for us. And he seemed like a pretty pleasant guy, probably the age I am now, he was then. And he looks down at me, and he kind of smiles, and he reaches into his wallet and he takes out his wallet, or reaches in his pocket, takes out his wallet and opens it up and shows me his badge. And he says, "Now you don't want an off-duty cop buying up for you, do you?" And I'm, "Oh no, sir!" And, you know, I go running off like, "Oh Jesus!" You know, I mean, I always claim that to be the first and the last time that a policeman showed me his badge, and I wasn't arrested soon after. I got on a really bad roll there of getting arrested a lot. I remember that night we were looking for oddly enough, maybe I could have been an AA when I was 13 if I had figured this out. But we were looking for a bottle of Bacardi 151. I remember we got our bottle of Bacardi 151. I remember we were down by the railroad tracks near where we lived and passing this bottle around, taking drinks. And, I mean, it just tasted awful. I mean, it just tasted awful. But I don't recall ever, you know, saying, I pass, go ahead. Every time it came around, you know, I wasn't going to not drink, you know, with my cool buddies there. But I know we didn't drink the whole bottle because I remember we were like building little trails and lighting them on fire. You know, I mean, we were just little kids. You know, we were probably burning army men, and you know, we were little boys. We didn't know what we were doing. But I don't recall getting necessarily drunk or getting sick or getting in trouble. Or I blacked out first time. I don't know, but I don't really recall having any consequence necessarily to that. And as a little kid, not a whole lot of drinking going on. Certainly not, as far as I could tell, a problem. Probably in high school, a little bit more drinking going on, a little bit of trouble here and there. My dad was a boxer, and so I grew up learning how to fight, which I wasn't very good. I wasn't very good in the ring, but outside the ring, I seemed to take a lot of pleasure in slugging people in the face, and which is really a bad habit. When you're a kid, it's one thing, but, you know, when you're 25 or something in a bar, you know, slugging people, it really doesn't go over very well. So I got into a little bit of trouble around that kind of stuff. And I would love to tell you, I really truly would love to tell you that when I drank, I did bad things. And that's not necessarily true in my case. I did a lot of bad things when I wasn't drinking. I'd love to blame alcohol, but alcohol wasn't really necessarily to blame. At some point in my drinking, I think it's true for a lot of us. I know it's true for me. Is at some point I crossed some kind of an invisible line where I went from drinking normally to drinking alcoholically. And I would have to say, looking back now, that invisible line was that at some point alcohol had become probably more of a solution in my life than it was really a problem. In other words, I'd have a lot of bad stuff going on. I'd have, you know, my wife throwing me out. Folks have, you know, want me nowhere near their house or them. I've lost yet another job. I've got warrants for my arrest. I've just got all this bad stuff going on. And what happens for me, and I would go down to the little local bar and I would take a drink, and just a drink. I'd kind of, you know, I just feel kind of the pressure let off a little bit, and I'd have 2-3 drinks. I'd be feeling pretty good. 6-10 drinks, and I am absolutely hooting and hollering, and I am just the happiest guy in the world. And what I had not known then that I know now is, for me, alcohol, it's like they say for an alcoholic, which is different than a non-alcoholic, is that when we drink, our problems actually go away. It's temporary, but my problems go away. What happens is I have those drinks and I'm feeling pretty good, and you know, I'll think things like, you know, my wife, I'll think, you know what? That woman never deserved to be married to a man like me anyway, you know? Let her go, you know? Three more better ones than that, no problem. You know, I think the job, I'd think, let them fire me, you know? That company will crumble, you know? It'll just straight to its knees, you know? They'll go under. And so my perception of reality really changed a lot with alcohol. And for me, as my drinking progressed, people were noticing, and the people that were noticing would tell me I had a problem, obviously, with drinking. And again, what I know now that I didn't know then, that I couldn't express to them is, and for me, it's sort of the ultimate, but you don't understand, for an alcoholic, is that, I mean, for me, it seemed that really the only peace in the world I was getting when I did have a couple of drinks in me. It was the only time that I felt okay. Because I could make all this stop, and I could make that actually sound like something else. Like I say, I could look at my life in a completely different light. I could see that I could get a much better job than the one I had. I could see that, you know, let them try and catch me for the warrants or whatever. I could get so on the other side of things that I actually felt pretty good. And my problem, and if you're here, I assume yours, is I would just overshoot the mark every time, you know. I'd kind of blow by that, you know, comfortable, feel-good kind of thing, and what I do is create sort of more problems in my life. I fell in love with bars from the first moment I stepped into the bars. I loved them. I love the look of a bar. I love the bar back and the mirrors and all the bottles. And I love the smell of bars. I love the women that hung out in bars. There was just, I just loved everything about bars from the moment I walked into them. And so I became a bartender, which, you know, made perfect sense to me. So I bartended for several years. I had met this fabulous gal when I was bartending, and my folks had, recently thrown me out of the house, I suppose. They changed the locks and put locks on the windows because a lot of bad stuff was happening and the police were coming by looking for me and stuff like that. So I wasn't living there anymore, but I kind of wanted to get back in mom and dad's good graces. And I can tell you that my full name, just so you know, is Patrick Timothy O'Leary. So kind of give you an idea of the whole cultural thing. But I met this girl who was born and raised in Ireland, and I thought, wow, now that's pretty cool. And I didn't want, you know, my mom and dad were actually doing okay financially, and I certainly didn't want to miss out on any of that when they died. So So I married this girl quickly. I always feel like I married her before she was able to read the warning label. And so I married her really fast. We knew each other, I think, about 7 or 8 months. I was on my best behavior, and we got married. And I would tell you tonight, and I knew this in my heart of hearts when I got married. I knew that once I had gotten married, that my life was going to change. That as a result of getting married, I would get a job and keep it, and I'd bring home a check, and we'd eventually buy a house and the white picket fence and the dog and the kids. And I really thought those things were all byproducts of my getting married. It doesn't work like that at all. I actually got really resentful about the whole being married thing. It's like I mean, I'd go to work if I was working on a Wednesday, and I'd come home on Sunday, and she'd be all bent out of shape, easy, a couple of days. I mean, no harm done. But I was doing a lot of things. I remember finding Al-Anon literature in my wife's nightstand, and I just went absolutely ballistic when I found this Al-Anon literature. I took a chair and just started basically beating the drywall off the walls of the place we lived, and I kicked our stereo in. I picked up our television and I threw it through a sliding glass door. I was drunk when this happened, and I was screaming constantly over and over at the top of my lungs, "You think I'm an alcoholic? You think I'm an alcoholic?" I was just so incredibly offended. I was thinking, after all I've done for you, this is what I get, So we, the marriage didn't last an incredibly long time. It didn't seem as though things were going quite the way my wife had hoped. And we had split up. I think we were married for about 2 years, and we split up. While we were married, I managed to get 3 drunk drivings in a matter of 6 weeks. 2 of them came in 3 nights. Same cop. Unbelievable. It's like a Thursday. It was a Thursday night, Friday morning. I'm driving. It's 2:30 in the morning, something like that, on a Friday morning. And a cop pulls me over and asks for my license and registration. I give him that. And so he wants me to get out and do the sobriety test. So I got out and I did that. And I felt I did okay. He disagreed. And so he handcuffed me and he put me in the back of the car, and we were on our way to jail. And and I told this guy, I said, "Look, I said, I just got a drunk driving like a month ago. Maybe you could cut me a break, maybe impound the car, lock me up, let me sleep it off, and whatever like this." And he said, "No, you're being arrested for drunk driving." And I, at that time, was a pretty limber guy, and I managed to get the cuffs underneath my rear end and get my feet out, and I get a cigarette out of my pocket. And I'm in the back of the police car smoking a cigarette like this. And this particular police officer was a rather heavy guy, and I felt it my judicial duty to point that out. I felt he should be in a little better shape to be a cop. And my vocabulary between that time and this has changed considerably, but you can imagine what I was saying to him. "You big fat, let's get out of the car." I wanted to get out. I wanted him and I to fight. So I told him that. I said, "Let's get out. Get the cuffs off. I'll kick. What I'm going to say." So we did get out, and he recuffed me again behind my back, and he slammed my face on the hood of his car a few times, and then we got back in, and we went to jail. So that was bad. The following morning, Saturday morning, I remember they let me out early in the morning, and I went to a 6 a.m. bar, a place called Mannion's in Burlingame, California. And I know a lot of people know 6 a.m. bars with no windows, really dark. And, people, I think, actually have cobwebs on them in there. I mean, it's like a really creepy place. But anyway, I needed a drink. And I don't know about you, but I don't know what else to do in that particular type of situation. So I started drinking that morning. It would only be hearsay if I was to tell you I drank from then until Saturday night, Sunday morning. because I really don't know what happened, but I do know that at about 2:15, 2:30 Sunday morning, I got pulled over in the same intersection by the same cop. And so he asked for my license and registration. I gave him that, and we did the sobriety test again. And again, I felt I did pretty well. He disagreed, and we went to he handcuffed me, and we got into the car. And when we got in the car, I said, after the other night, I feel kind of like I know you. And I said, maybe you could cut me a break, maybe impound the car, let me sleep it off. And he said, no, you're going to be arrested for drunk driving. And I was a pretty limber guy back then. And I start the whole thing, oh, you big fat, you know, and I start on at this guy again. I mean, I still have dry blood on my face from the beating he had given me a couple nights before. And I'm just, the mouth is just going, right? It's a bit of a long story. And the only reason that I tell it is it basically depicts what my life was like from sort of then on out is I would just continually do things the way I thought I should do them. And I somehow expected that the result of that was going to be different. I don't know if on that Sunday morning, if the guy was going to stop and go, you know what, Mr. O'Leary, you're right. No, I apologize. I'm way out of line doing this to you. I didn't know if he was going to invite me out for dinner and dancing. I mean, what am I? I'm being arrested. I'm drunk. I'm driving my car. So, soon after my wife had thrown me out, I moved into a studio apartment in San Mateo, which is where I basically bottomed out, I suppose. I slept all day. I drank all night. I didn't work. I had checks though, which was awesome because that I got, you know, first and last. I'm writing these checks from an account that doesn't exist. It's not even insufficient funds. It had been closed months before, but I still had this box of checks, which was really cool. So I was writing checks all over the place. I remember this guy comes to repossess my car and he said, you know, Mr. O'Leary, I've made a payment in 4 months. You're going to need to make a payment, give us a check or something. I said, you take checks? He said, yeah, we can take a check. I said, how much I owe on the car total? You know, oh, well, $10,000, you know, $212.80. I'll be right back. I go, get my checkbook. Am I writing him a check for the whole amount? You know, I'm Mr. Big Show. Oh, thank you, Mr. O'Leary. You know, and he runs off. And I had the car another 3 or 4 days. They found it and took it. But I, at that point, had managed to get, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 17, 18 warrants for my arrest. And I turned myself in on the warrants. The truth is, I would love to say that I wanted to clean up the wreckage of the past and go take care of, you know, this debt to society or whatever you want to call it. But the truth is I just felt I'd probably be better taken care of in jail than I would out here trying to take care of myself. I knew that I'd be clothed. I knew I'd be fed. You know, lights on, lights off. You know, I mean, my life would be much more organized. And it's just funny today to think. You know, I mean, the best decision I know what I'll do. I'll go to jail. That's good thinking. But ultimately, I guess it was because the first day that I was in jail was January 17th of 1989. The first day that I got sober was the first day that I was in jail. I would say that if you have anything whatsoever to do with H&I, I thank you for my life because I just don't think I get to stand here if there's not such thing as H&I. If you've ever had a desire to get involved in H&I, I'd suggest that you go ahead and do that because they gave me, you know, literature and stuff, and I went to some of the meetings, and I would love to tell you that I was, you know, I was real hip to this stuff. I wanted to get sober and all that, but it's just simply not the case. On the night they let me out, my first 9 months or so of sobriety was spent in jail. When they I mentioned it, Chris. You told me I should. The first 9 months of my sobriety was spent in jail. I remember when I got out, H&I had given me a softback big book, and I remember taking that and I put it on the shelf in the cell. And you know, when I said I won't need this anymore, because I figured I'm going out, I'll be fine now. And I would have to tell you probably the most significant thing that's ever happened to me in my life happened that next day, and that's that I went to an AA meeting. And I would say I have no idea why I did that. I didn't want necessarily what you had because I guess I just couldn't see it. I just didn't know where else to go. I thought these H&I guys came in. They said AA is out there. It's available. It's a place you can go. And so I started going to AA meetings. I lived in some bushes at that time, down the street from a place called 180 Poplar, which is an address, but it's where they have meetings, and they have meetings four times a day there. And I went to all of them. I'd get to the meetings early. I'd get into the bathroom, take a little hobo bath, pick the leaves out of my hair, and try and smell as decent as I could, and go to the AA meetings. And I would have to tell you that there were a lot of very, very good people there who probably had absolutely no business being as kind to me as they were, but they were, and that was, I think, a little bit strange. But I went to the meetings. It was like probably 3 months that I was living in the bushes down the street. I can remember leaving the bushes where I was, and I'd be, heading down to the meeting, and I'd walk by another area of bushes, and I'd think, this looks nice. I don't think, good tree cover, a cleared out area. It doesn't look like anyone's living here. I'm thinking about moving, I got to go down a little closer to the meeting, a little hoity-toity now, I go down and get my grocery bag and bring it down and put it down there. But good people were kind to me there. And again, I guess I didn't know for a while why that was, as I do today. But I found a home group, 405 El Camino in Burlingame, is a men's stag. And I found my way to somehow spending time around people who knew what you were supposed to do to stay sober. I got a sponsor. I was maybe 3 years sober before I wrote a four-step. That's not a recommendation by any means, but I just couldn't trust anybody. I come in AA a pretty untrustworthy guy, and I just assumed you the same. But it took a while, but I eventually did do a four-step. I had one guy who sponsored me. This guy was really something. He had a big, gigantic gold Rolex, and he had like four or five cars and several houses and the country club membership and all that. And they had said, get somebody to sponsor you that has what you want. And so I asked Bob to sponsor me, and Bob sponsored me for about a year and a half. And I'm sure Bob did fine. I didn't want Bob to think there was anything wrong with me, which is kind of funny because I'm in AA. But I didn't want Bob to know there was anything wrong with me, so I just always told Bob I was doing okay. And I eventually got another guy to sponsor me, Jerry, and Jerry's dead now. He's the first person I ever worked a four-step with. And Jerry was a little crustier than Bob. He had a very, very messy little apartment that he rented. Jerry wasn't much to look at, but I don't think I get to stand here if Jerry wasn't a part of my life. So I wrote a four-step. A lot of people seem to find some kind of jubilation of some kind in that. That wasn't my experience. I was basically looking at a piece of paper that showed me what it was that I had become. And I don't think my mom nor dad ever intended or hoped for me to become what I had become. I don't think any of my three sisters had hoped for that. I know it was far less than I had hoped for myself. But it was the reality of who I was. But taking those steps with Jerry, I guess to a degree, changed my life. I guess then I didn't know how much. It seems to me that at some point in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to cross another sort of an invisible line where I go from being a taker to being a giver. And I think that's what Jerry showed me. While Jerry sponsored me, Jerry's mother, Jerry's father, Jerry's wife, and Jerry's sponsor all died in like a year and a half. And just saw Jerry just kind of go tumbling down. But I tell you, he still had time to spend with me. And I just in awe of that. I just couldn't see how he could be concerned about me when he had all going on that he had going on in his own life. The woman that I had been married to, we had after a couple of years in AA, we had started dating, which is not an experience we had previously had. I was kind of more of a hostage taker, really, than a dater. But we started dating. I could call her up and say, you want to go see a movie or you want to go and have dinner or something like that. And we kind of started doing that. And we just kind of realized that, you know, we did have enough in common to be married. And we're still, I mean, this December will be 19 years, Siobhan and I will be married. And I just say me on the finest day of my life, the best I could ever be. Compared to my wife on the worst day of her life, as bad as she could ever be, I have outdone myself by a huge margin. I was outclassed by her the day I married her. I'm outclassed by her today. And I don't know why it is that I was able to wind up with this lady, but I'm awful glad that I have. I was always a big fan of kids, always have liked children. Never thought I would have kids, only because I just feel like guys who, you know, throw televisions through sliding glass doors, you know, shouldn't really be dads. You know, that's changed as well. I have a daughter who in April will be 13 years old, and my son will be 9 in March. And, like, my son had his last soccer game of the year today. They were actually undefeated all season. They had their last game of the year today, and I missed that because it came here. And I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. Most times, to be honest, like right now, you know, I mean, today, I'd have rather been at that game than coming up here to do this. I'd rather be home with my family than I would be here. But there's something that I know for an absolute fact, and that is that if I don't come here, I don't get to go there. You know, if I don't have you, I don't have them. It's so clear as day for me. It's just incredible. Left to my own devices without having the involvement of Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor and the steps and the people of AA, I will burn that down so fast. And I won't do it intentionally. I won't want that to happen. I'll have no desire to ruin what I have, but I just know me well enough to know I will just burn it down just that fast. Like I say, my son will be 9. When he was 5 years old, I remember walking into his room one day, and he's sitting in his room, and he's playing with some little dinosaurs or some guys or something. And I said, how you doing, buddy? He said, I'm good, Daddy. He said, Daddy, you know, I was just thinking, he said, if I had just one wish in the world, he said, just one wish, he said, I would wish that you were 5 and that we could be best friends and grow up together forever. And I would just tell you that is the finest compliment I've ever been paid in my life. I think it would be pretty arrogant of me to ever expect to be paid a higher compliment than that. My daughter, I think she was the same age, 5 years old, and I'm driving her to school one day to kindergarten, and she's in the back seat of the car, and I'm driving, and she's sitting in the back seat of the car, and she's going like this, thumping her hand on her palm of her hand on her forehead, and I'm looking at her in the mirror. I says, Claire, I said, what are you doing? She says, I'm trying to make my brain clear. I said, yeah. I said, why are you trying to make your brain clear? She said, in case God wants to talk to me. I said, wow. I said, really? I said, does God talk to you? And she said, no, she hasn't yet, but I want my brain to be clear in case she does. I swear to God, I thought I'd get about 2 blocks down the road and jump in the back seat and go, am I doing this right? You know? I've got all these books on meditation, you know, I'm trying to figure all this stuff out. And she's got it going on at 5 years old, you know. I was telling Chris earlier, I think I was talking to Chris about that earlier, somebody, she's on the phone, and she's 5 years old, and she's on the phone with my mom. And I know that what my mom said to her is, Claire, what are you doing? Because she took the phone away like this, and she looked at the phone a little funny, she goes, talking to you on the phone. And I mean, to her, it was like the oddest, don't you know what we're doing? Because she wasn't coloring or watching TV or, you know, doing a puzzle or whatever. She was talking to Grandma on the phone. I swear I saw that and I thought, you know, I want what she has. I'm never there. I mean, you know, I'm never where I'm supposed to be. I ended up moving from the peninsula over to Pleasanton, which is in the East Bay and in San Francisco Bay Area, and I got hooked up with a group there, a men's group again, and got another got myself another sponsor there, and this guy, I tell you, Glenville is 70 plus years old, 40 plus years sober, and he still is changing. I mean, he still allows himself to change. He hasn't gotten stuck in this sort of, you know, 40-year sober thing. He's he just seems pretty flexible in his life to change, and he's just a beautiful guy, and I he's helped me in my sobriety tremendously. Probably more than anything is learning how to take these steps down off the wall and apply them in my life as a way of life, to use these steps. I don't prioritize. I don't put sort of AA first and then family, and then I just, AA just happens to be the basis of how I live my life, and my family is the thing that comes first after that. But AA is basically, I use the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, at least I try to live my life. I've had some incredible experiences in AA. There was, I was probably 6 years sober, 7 years sober, and I was doing the meditation thing. And I kept getting this idea in my head to go to the California Bar and Grill, which is a bar where I used to drink. And I'm thinking, you know, that's a bad idea. Make that one go away. And I go on about my business. I keep getting this idea in my head. So I said, you know, what the hell, I'll go. So I went to the California Bar and Grill. The guy who owned it was sober, not an Alcoholics Anonymous, but he had not drank for several years. And so I thought, well, I'll go see Bob. Go say hello. I walked in the bar about 10:30 in the morning, and I'm going back to the kitchen to see Bob, and there's one guy sitting at the bar. It was a guy I used to drink with. His name was Jim. And Jim's sitting up at the bar, and he was the only guy in there sitting up at the bar, and there was a bartender. And I went back looking for Bob. Bob wasn't there, and I started to leave, and Jim turns, and he looks at me, and he says, hey, Patrick. I said, hey, Jim, how you doing? He said, I'm okay. He said, can I talk to you for a minute? I said, sure. Jim had been sitting in the bar drinking a Coke the night before. Jim got drunk, actually the day before, in the afternoon. Jim got pretty drunk, went home, tried to go to sleep in his apartment, and right across the street is a tow truck company. There's a tow truck idling, you know, that diesel idle annoying noise. And it was bothering Jim while he was trying to sleep. So he came out and he started yelling at the guy, shut off the truck, hey, use, you know, blah. And these guys are kind of arguing back and forth, and Jim got tired of arguing, so went and got a gun. And he came back, and so he's trying to shoot the tow truck guy. With his gun, blew a couple of holes in his truck, and of course, you know, the tow truck guy surrendered and turned off the truck. So Jim went back to bed. And of course, you know, moments later, the door gets kicked in and the police are in. And do you have any other weapons? No, I don't. I think he had 8 more guns. And Jim had gone to jail, and they let him out that morning that I saw him. And the odd part is this, is I hadn't been in that bar in 6 years. Hadn't really any contact with anybody from that bar in that length of time. Jim was in the bar trying to muster up the courage to ask the bartender if he knew my phone number, because he knew that I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's funny sometimes to think of myself, you know, I'll question whether there's a God in my life or not. And I just don't know why I would ever question that. I clearly have nothing to do with that. Jim stayed sober for a little while. Jim got drunk, got sober, got drunk, and I don't know where he's at today, but I certainly know that there's some kind of a God working in my life with that kind of stuff going on. Got a call a couple of years ago to go on a 12-step call, and we went on this 12-step call out in a little town called Springtown, and we went to the Springtown Motel. And when we walked up, me and my buddy Dave had decided that we do the good cop, bad cop thing. And so Dave said, I'll be the bad cop, you be the good cop. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. So we go and knock on the door of this little motel, and took, like, the motel is like the size of this podium. I don't know how it took the guy so long to get to the door, but he's an alcoholic. So so eventually the door opens up, and this guy is standing there. He's got to be 6'6", maybe 6'7", probably 350. And I swear to God, the first thing I thought is, thank goodness I'm the good cop. You know, but we sat down with this guy. This guy's name was Ben, and he was, he's about my father's age. And we sat and talked with this guy for a while. And one of the things we had found out is that, Ben was in that room. He had been there for about 6-8 weeks, staying in this motel room. And he had a half gallon of vodka sitting on a little nightstand and a little clear Dixie cup, about half full of vodka, and 6 or 8 cans of tuna. And he had been in that room held up eating tuna and drinking vodka for a month and a half. And I guess just keeping himself alive to drink, I suppose. I can't imagine there was anything else going on in Ben's life. But we had talked to him for some time, and apparently the good cop appealed to him. I talked to him on the phone that night several times, but this one time, I'd say it was probably midnight, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, and we're talking on the phone, and we had tried to get him into a detox and things like this. But Ben had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 14 years. And at that time had been then out drinking for about 3 years. And I remember talking to Ben on the phone, and this, you know, midnight, 1 in the morning thing. And Ben keeps repeating to me, and he's crying, and he keeps repeating to me, he says, "I just don't know why you're doing this for me. I don't know why you're doing this for me." And I don't know where this came from, but I said, "Hey, Ben," I said, "if you don't know why I'm doing this for you, I know why you're drunk. AA, at some point, I've got to stop coming here to get something from Alcoholics Anonymous. At some point, I'm going to have to find my way in this program to try and do something for somebody. It's very unnatural to me. And I assume most of you, I mean, it's a part of alcoholism that I think is, it's prevalent. It's certainly prevalent in my life. But I try to do that. I have a lot of guys that I get to sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor and you're not asking anybody because you're afraid to do it, I would suggest getting on the other side of it and imagine what it would be like if another man said to you, or in a woman's case, a woman were to say to you, "Can I trust you with my entire life?" Because it's absolutely nothing short of that. It's again, I think, about the highest compliment that a person in Alcoholics Anonymous can be paid is being asked to sponsor someone. I'm head over heels in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful that you all let me come up here and speak, and I thank you very much for my life.